And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. Today on the program, we're going to be talking to Dr. Tejanin Rudasingwa about developments in Rwanda. There's some dramatic news today. I understand that an accused who was standing to be nominated for president, she spent 12 months in jail. She's in court today, so we're going to be asking about that. And later in the program, we will speak to Otis Richmond about a meeting going to be organized at the a different book list. We have some important speakers coming to Toronto. And lastly, we will be talking to author Keith Bolander about his course on modern Cuban-American relations. But right now, I think we are joined by Dr. Rudasingwa. Are you there, sir?
I'm there. How are you?
Very good. Thank you very much for joining us. There is news today, and I guess it would be a good place to start. As I understand it, Victoire Ingabire appeared in court today, and she's been incarcerated for 12 months. She returned to the country, as I understand it, in order to contest for the presidency of Rwanda, The judge in the court in the case referred to the defense as barbarians. Are you surprised that all these things are unfolding in your country? What's going on?
No, I'm not. I'm not at all surprised. I think the trial itself is sham. It simply shows how far things have gone to the extreme with regard to the politics of our country. And the abuse of human rights, the misuse of even the existing courts, because Victor Ingabire, like many others, were in jail today, are political prisoners for no other reason other than that they simply wanted to participate in the political process in the country. Mm-hmm. And Kagame simply does not want that to happen, so that's why she's in jail. So the whole process is sham, and it's evident how Kagame manipulates the judiciary to his own political advantage.
Mm-hmm. Tell our listeners again, we're speaking to Dr. Rudasingwa. He is the former Rwandan ambassador to the United States. He is the coordinator of the Rwandan National Congress. Dr. Rudasingwa, you were present at an important meeting on September the 16th in Washington, D.C., what kind of issues did we raise there by spokespersons for former prominent leaders in Rwanda? What issues were you addressing?
Yeah, we were in Washington, D.C. on the 16th of this month, together with our partners, that is Victor and Gabriel's party leaders, were with us, and what we're trying to do jointly as a coalition for change was really to begin to explain to the Washington kind of network of people, the kind of crowd that is in Washington, D.C., the plight of our country, to explain that our country is once again in danger, as it was in the early 90s, and to explain why the United States government and the British government, which are the two key partners to the current regime in Rwanda, that they need to understand how their policies impact on the internal politics in Rwanda and how their close relationship with Kagame might end up actually being a constraint in terms of change. Mm-hmm. And I think it is very evident that I think United Kingdom and Washington, D.C. are beginning to understand the challenges that we are facing in Rwanda. Mm-hmm. And how Rwanda's internal politics also impacts on other countries in the region, particularly the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that could be underlined, I assume. I seem to recall maybe 3-4 months ago that the British government informed a Rwandan exile living in London that his life was in danger, that literally assassins from Rwanda were coming to that country intended to come and to assassinate him. That's very – what kind of government is – isn't it rather incredible that 2011 we have a government that actually sends assassins?
Oh, yes. I think when it comes to President Kagame and his regime, that actually is like commonplace, because that's what he has always done. That's what he was doing before 94. That's what he has done since 1994. And not only what happened in the United Kingdom, where only, you know, surprised that the UK authorities should come out in public to announce that. But that's what, for most of us in Rwanda, Rwandans who are in the country, who are simply living in fear, like hostages within that small country. Mm-hmm. But it's what we go through every day. You might have heard this week that, in fact, security agents were trying again to assassinate General Kayumba in South Africa. And so for most of us, we live with that daily challenge of how to dodge Kagame's long arm of trying to destroy people he calls opponents or enemies, which translated simply means anybody who does not follow the government line of Tari Kagame's version of things and his actions within the country.
Yeah. I don't know if I understood you exactly. I know the name General Yamwasa. He is in South Africa. Did you say there was another attempt on someone else, or was it?
Yes, no. There was another attempt actually just a couple of days ago, and this time, because General Nyamwasa is under the protection of the South African government, what Kagame's agents, security agents, did was to buy their way through the security network. And it was only discovered at the last moment that indeed they wanted to go and came once again. So this is really a repeated pattern of what Kagame does on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. I read an article by yourself and a second individual's name escapes me, but at today, where you were, I think there was a quotation from a Belgian professor, Mr. Rentjens. Where he says, and I think it's related to this issue of professional assassins and all. He says that in Rwanda, you have an army that owns the country. You don't have a country that has an army.
Yes, in fact,
is that accurate?
Probably the further qualification I would even give to that is that it's not even the entire army. It's like the Rwandese Patriotic Front, which is supposed to be the ruling party, or the RPA, which became the government army since 1994 after RPF's military victory. But within the military itself, Kagame hires a couple of people, and their entire Tutsi is 100% Tutsi officers. Mm-hmm. And there are quite a few of them. So it's actually Kagame and these very, very few officers that really own the country. And it doesn't matter whether there is an army of 50,000 or 60,000, or whether there is something called the ruling party, mm-hmm. because all these institutions are like rubber stamps. In effect, it's the informal network of Kagame and a few Tutsi military officers that own the country.
More something more akin to a gang than a constitutional entity.
And it's a criminal gang, actually, because when you see Kagame has, gradually but effectively criminalized the state institutions, especially the security institutions, and so it's him and a couple of other military officers that run the show of intimidating and killing people within the country and harassing them abroad.
Mm-hmm. Now, they do this under a rubric. I know that you must be concerned. You've written a number of articles, and certainly your work speaks to this matter, that people in the West have a hard time getting a handle on who Mr. Kagame, President Kagame is, and how he exercises authority. And one term that I notice is used often, and was certainly is used, I think, against Victoire Ingabire, is genocide ideology. And you, by the way, a former ambassador, your doctor, have you yourself been accused of this?
No, but now I'm like a sympathizer because these terms have been used extensively and generally, especially against any Hutu. So any member from the Hutu community who raises his or her voice or who wants to point out the excesses of the government, the human rights abuses, the closure of the political space, the fact that there is no independent media, absolutely no independent media in the country, and anybody who talks about civil society or about, you know, Kagame's dictatorial regime, such a Hutu is normally branded a genocidal or somebody who has a revisionist ideas about genocide. Or, of course, of late, they also accused of being associated with the fighting groups in the Congo. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in the case of Ingabire, they say that she is connected to some terrorists. So for Hutus, it has generally been that. If you are opposed to the regime, you become a genocide. Now, for us, like me, a Tutsi, or somebody like Gahima or General Nyamwasa or Karegeya or any other Tutsi who falls out with Kagame, normally we are supposed to be corrupt. And increasingly, of course, they say that we are terrorists. And as you know, I have been sentenced to 24 years in jail together with General Nyamwasa and Patrick Karegeya, and Gahima were given 20 years.
Oh, you've been like in absentia, is that right?
In absentia, yes, in absentia. And the only crime that we're accused of is for having written, this other paper we wrote sometime last year in August, called Rwanda Briefing, in which we dissected Kagame's regime and warned our countrymen and women that Rwanda is sliding into chaos with potential for the very serious violence if, for example, we don't change course. And it's on that basis that he tried us in absentia and sentenced us to all those years in jail.
My goodness. It is really a remarkable situation. And I'll remind our listeners, we are speaking to Dr. Rudasingwa. He is a former Rwandan ambassador to the United States, and he has raised the alarm about the type of government that President Paul Kagame is conducting. I know you've addressed a rather burning issue. At the end of this year, the United Nations Agency for Refugees is changing the status of Rwandan refugees. I know of people in Zambia, for example. They're going to be defined in such a way that they could be forced to return en masse.
Absolutely. And that's, we've been raising our voices. I think right now we are launching a big campaign. Hopefully also in Canada, here in the United States, in Europe, in Africa, that the international community must not listen to Kagame's manipulation, because he simply wants to get all these refugees repatriated by force, when in fact the conditions in the country are such that more and more people are running away from the country simply because of these absolute human rights abuses. I'm sure the listeners have been hearing about the horrendous war crimes against humanity and possible acts of genocide that were committed against Congolese and Hutus in the Democratic Republic of Congo. They have had of human rights abuses within Rwanda itself. So how not, and the legitimate representatives of the Hutus, people like Victor Ingabire and others, are languishing in jail. So, and the rest of the population have simply beaten into silence because of fear, and they live like second-class citizens within Rwanda. And it used to be Hutus who are running away from the country. Now the Tutsis are also running away from the country. So why would Kagame be interested in actually coercing the Rwandan refugees to be returned by force? The only reason is that he knows as long as refugees remain outside, then unless the conditions in the, within the country change, and is not about to change within the country, he knows that that is something that can drive conflict in the coming years, because that's how Kagame came into power. That's how RPF was born in exile. The problem of Rwandan refugees tends to create very serious problems for Rwanda, and Kagame knows that. And so he's trying to use strong arm tactics of coercing and manipulating the international community to support him in that. And so all of us people who understand all these things, and people who love peace and people who support Rwandans must work together to make sure that that does not happen.
We're speaking to Dr. Rusingwa. He is a coordinator of the Rwanda National Congress and was the former ambassador to the United States representing Rwanda. Dr. Rusingwa, I wonder if you could talk about the claim that Rwanda is developing because the argument is used that, well, Tony Blair, former prime minister, is there. There's been U.S. and British money, and therefore the people of Rwanda are prospering, and even though their freedoms are not available, that they should be happy. How do you react to that? Is that accurate about the economy?
Yes, I'm glad you raised that issue. Indeed, all of us Rwandans are supposed to be happy. We're supposed to be developing very fast. They say we've been developing at the rate of, 6 to 11% GDP every year since 1994. Partly what they're saying is that Rwanda started from a very disadvantaged position in 1994, and there's no doubt that some progress has been made. But this progress that people are talking about is highly exaggerated, because number one, Rwanda remains a predominant agrarian subsistence economy. Most of the people in Rwanda live on less than a dollar per day.
$1.
And yes, less than a dollar per day. And most of what people describe as the development about Rwanda is something that, of course, is supported by large infusions of foreign money from the international community, notably the British, of course, and the Americans, and the World Bank and the IMF. And it's mainly around the capital city where actually mostly the regime's supporters, especially, a small group of Tutsis live. And so they say they are clean streets, there are all these buildings. But really, in Rwanda, increasingly, there are even more serious inequalities between the countryside and Kigali. But having said that, even if there was a bit of this development, I think people should never forget that this is not development, or lack of development is not what drives conflict in Rwanda. The regime that was toppled in '73. Or the regime that Habyarimana presided over. In fact, 1989, shortly before RPF invaded Rwanda, Rwanda would have been described as actually one of the best performers in terms of how aid is utilized. The main problem of Rwanda that has not been resolved is the question of power, the power that becomes entrenched in the hands of a small minority. Sometimes it's Hutu, and now it has bounced back to the Tutsi. And so unless something like that is resolved, and unless we deal with the issues of accountability, of human rights, of opening up political space and making sure that Rwanda is run by institutions rather than by one man, then we slide back into the kind of situation that produces all these problems of the past, like civil war and genocide and bloodshed and refugees. And so, and now, one thing I should mention before I finish commenting on this, I'm sure the listeners probably have seen that Kagame was the most notorious offender last week in New York, because it was reported by the New York Times that, compared even to the guys who come from the Arab world who have a lot of petrodollars, compared even to Cameron, the British Prime Minister, who gives lots of money to Kagame, or even to Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Kagame was the guy who sleeps in 20,000 a night kind of hotel. Imagine 20,000 a night.
He's ascetic. That's a lot of dough for a guy who doesn't need much.
Did you see that Kagame was the notorious offender? It was reported by New York Times.
Yeah.
So how can we talk about development, about the incorruptible Kagame, when a guy, pays 20,000 a night when his countrymen and women languish on less than a dollar per day?
And the population makes $1 a day, 80%.
Yes, yes. And of course, I'm sure it's raising eyebrows in London and Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. And by the way, you're at RwandaInfo.com. I read your an article where you were making proposals to the American and British governments particularly, but I assume that addressed to Canada as well, calling on them to say to Kagame that he should release the political prisoners, such as Madam Ingabire, and stop the arbitrary arrests. But you also say, why give aid to him unless you're going to insist, as democratic countries, that he adhere to these principles?
Absolutely. I think the tendency in the past was that, this whole narrative that because Rwanda suffered genocide and so people should not push Kagame very hard and give him benefit of doubt. And so the international community, particularly the Americans and the British, have given him almost like a blank check.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what we are saying is that that can easily fuel a conflict and may have very serious and intended consequences, because it makes Kagame very intransigent, and he goes away with impunity. He thinks he can imprison people. He thinks he can harass and kill people. He thinks that he can, use public money as private money as much as he wants, and that nobody's going to ask him questions. Part of the problem is what has been described as the guilt conscience of the West in the run-up to the genocide and immediately after.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of this, the international community has tended to be very timid. And what we are saying is that 17 years later, Kagame should be asked to account for the crimes he has committed, mm-hmm. to account for lack of political space in the country, and to begin to talk to the opposition, because clearly without having dialogue between the current government and the opposition, then the alternative to that is that we slide possibly into another cycle of violence. And that's not something that Rwandans or people in the region or the international community want to happen. So we are insisting that if they are giving him aid, then should come as aid with conditions. And one of the conditions should be that whole issue of talking to the opposition, opening the political space, and stopping the human rights abuses.
Mm-hmm. Now, and Doctor, you've made an assessment now of him. Of course, Kagame was a soldier, and he was in the Ugandan army at one time, actually a ranking figure. Were you surprised that the international tribunal there in Arusha never found any evidence against anyone connected to him from the events in 1990 through
94? Oh, actually, that's part of the problem, because, as you know, justice in Rwanda is generally looked at, especially by one section of the community, I mean the Hutu. They look at it as the victim as justice, because whereas people who committed crimes or allegedly committed crimes related to genocide had been tried within the country, within Rwanda, under the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and Arusha. When it comes to members of our own organization, RPF, and the military wing RPA, those who committed serious human rights abuses in Rwanda, and now recently with the coming out of the 1st of October last year report, the mapping report on Congo, all these things actually the International Criminal Tribunal has never been interested in investigating them. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it is not that no evidence was found. Actually, the problem is that even with overwhelming evidence, the international community has not been interested in bringing Kagame to account for this crime.
And Dr. Rusingwa, on that point, there are many Congolese, and I believe even the Congolese government has brought charges, have they not? And they've simply been ignored by the by Britain and the United States.
Well, yes, it's really very, and these are some of the things that we keep on raising and trying to raise the profile. Even since the coming out of the report last year, 1 year later, we ask ourselves what has happened to this report. It's probably gathering dust on the shelves in the United Nations. And so many people are saying, well, was there a deal brokered between Kagame and the United Nations and the United States and the United Kingdom? Because remember, once the report came out, Kagame threw a tantrum and said he was going to withdraw his troops from Darfur. You remember that?
Yes.
And he ended up not withdrawing them, and somehow things fell silent. And so it's pure speculation that probably a deal was made. I have no idea about that. But this silence by the international community is part of what fuels impunity in Rwanda.
You know, your work at the Rwanda National Council and the position you've taken, you must have the Congolese must be grateful that to hear your voices because, I mean, what you're saying seems to offer a peaceful resolution also with Congo. Congo is a very dangerous place for Rwanda and Rwandans, if because of the incursions into that country by the general's armies.
Yeah, but the Congo, I often say that you never choose your neighbors, and Rwanda has found itself in that neighborhood with Burundi, Congo, Tanzania, Uganda. We are neighbors, and we've generally lived peaceful together for most of history. But I think the events of 94, before and after 1994, have really impacted on Congo in a major way. As you know, Congo has lost, by some estimate, close to 6 million people, those who have died directly due to conflict or to complications related to conflict. So Congo has suffered so much. Mm-hmm. So it seems mismanagement of political programs and social programs in Rwanda has an impact on the Congo. And, of course, Congo's situation also impacts on Rwanda. But part of the problem that we have now is that Kagame has determined, and I know this for a fact because that's what he says within these limited circles that he operates through, and I used to belong to that limited circle, to that kitchen cabinet. He says that Rwandans do not need a strong Congo, that in fact, Rwanda must always try to make sure that Congo remains disunited and remains very weak. Uh-huh. And that's why he fights a proxy war within the Kivus. Uh-huh. And I think that's a very dangerous proposal because he assumes that Congo will always remain fragmented and very weak. But I don't think that Congo will remain like that. It's going through trouble, but I'm sure at some point we'll gather it up together, and it may take a lot of time. And so this has fueled a lot of animosity of Congolese towards Rwanda, and particularly towards the Tutsi and Banyamulenge.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
indeed.
Because Kagame uses these people, uses some of the few people within these communities within Congo to destabilize Congo.
Yes, he's always going to rescue them, isn't he?
And he doesn't love them. Kagame doesn't love anybody. I think he only loves himself. He doesn't care about Tutsis in Rwanda. He doesn't care about Banyamulenge in Congo. He doesn't care about Hutus. For Kagame, what he truly, truly cherishes and cares so first and foremost is actually his own power. Yeah. And he will go to great lengths to sustain it, even by destabilizing Congo.
Yeah. Well, that's a powerful statement. Dr. Rudasingwa, of the Rwanda National Congress. We're very grateful. It's very informative. I hope we can talk to you again.
Thank you so much, and have a great evening.
Our best wishes. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Dr. Dejanin Rudasingwa. He was the former ambassador to the United States from Rwanda, and as he points out, many Rwandans, Tutsi, and who were in his same, were part of the RPF, and very prominent individuals are now living abroad trying to tell the government of the United States and tell Canada, tell the world, listen, you got a pretty dangerous guy in Paul Kagame. And we, how dangerous is he? He made an attempt on the life of General Yamwasa in South Africa. Assassins went there to kill him. That was about a year ago. And now, by the way, he's telling us today that there's been a new attempt on a second former Rwandan general living in South Africa. By the way, I advise the South African police, they better be on their toes because something really ugly is going to happen. I think we're joined now by Norman Otis Richmond, a legendary broadcaster and an encyclopedia on politics and music. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, a legend in my own mind.
No, there's two of us now think you're a legend. So we're going to call a vote. you have an important event you're associated with that's going to be at a different book list tomorrow, right?
No, it's going to be Saturday.
Oh, Saturday. By the way, there is something I better go ahead and broadcast it. 746 Bathurst.
Sister Soldier is going to be there Friday, I believe.
Well, this one is going to be a talk Tuesday, the 27th. I'll get that in, and then we'll ask you about the event where you're connected with. It's Slavery in Public Memory with Dr. Digna Castaneda Fuertes from Cuba. That's going to be tomorrow at a different book list at 7 p.m. But the event you're speaking of is, did you say Saturday?
It's October the 1st. It's going to be between 7 and 9. And it's a discussion of Manny Mirabal's book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention.
Mm-hmm. Now, that book, I don't know how long it's been out, but it's Malcolm X, and a book about Malcolm X is always draws tremendous amount of interest. But this was supposed to be the definitive book and very melodramatic and macabre situation. The author died.
He died the day he was the day after, I guess he died a few days before the book was released, and I think he passed away on a Friday, and that Saturday he was supposed to be at a bookstore in Los Angeles called SO1, and the book came out, and it's supposed to be humanizing Malcolm X, but it's caused quite a controversy. I guess the positive things about it is that anything, new information about Malcolm, is positive. But he seemed to have got into a situation where he sort of tried to turn Malcolm into a social democrat and talked about
him. It turned out that Malcolm was a lot like himself, right?
Right. He was a... There was a lot of drama in the bedroom. It was a lot of...
Well, that sells books. I know that Mary Baraka on Democracy Now, he very boldly spoke of all this, and he went after this. And it's really difficult, isn't it? I mean, you have a very prominent author. He dies, and you want to have an argument, but unfortunately, he's deceased. And Mary Baraka had spoken to the author himself, and he was looking forward to a kind of a productive debate, but he had to go ahead and say that this sensational personal or private information, which was not even information, just rumors,
right,
is good for selling books, but it doesn't really help you get at who was the public figure, Malcolm X, and what did he stand for, and why are we still so vibrantly talking about him? Everybody... there's hardly any discussion of President Obama or the issue of the recent execution of this young man, Troy Davis, the hunger strike of black prisoners, primarily black prisoners in California. Well, everybody brings up the name Malcolm X.
He kind of implied that if Malcolm were living today, that he would be supporting Barack Hussein Obama, and that Malcolm would be for he was for armed struggle in the so-called Third World, but he was not for that in the United States of America. And I really
that would surprise a lot of people.
And I don't think that Malcolm was talking about by any means necessary meant writing a letter, voting, as well as challenging the state by whatever means you have to.
He was an early advocate of something that's highly popular amongst the Tea Party people, which is self-defense. It's just that they only mean for white people.
Mm-hmm.
If they see a black person who believes in self-defense, they're not so excited. By the way, I assume all this is going to be talked about Saturday night. Tell us who's talking, and again, it'll be where and when, and what do you expect to hear?
Well, Dr. William Sales, who is the author of a book called From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, he will be on Skype. Mm-hmm. And Bill Sales is, I should say that he was one of the people that was invited to Cuba, I guess in 1992, when Fidel invited a number of African people from the United States to Cuba. I think Asada Shakur was there. I know she was there.
Mm-hmm.
Abdullah Kalimat, Muhammad Ahmed, Rosemary Mealy, and subsequently Bill Sells' daughter went to Cuba, and she's a doctor now, but she was trained in Cuba. So he will be on Skype, and he wrote a very powerful book called Civil Rights. From Civil Rights to Black Liberation, Malcolm X and the Organization of Afro-American Unity.
Mm-hmm. Hey, but he can interact, of course, because of Skype.
It's supposed to be Skype, yes.
People will mm-hmm. be able to put questions. We're in this Orwellian world where this he will be there, and people can talk to him, but he's also going to be wherever he is.
He's going to be, he's based in Peekskill, New York, which is, I think that's where Paul Robeson had a...
They tried to kill Paul
Robeson. Yeah, a real...
There's a book by Howard Fast about that.
Mm-hmm. So, and we are encouraging everybody to, you know, of course, read the book, and the book will be on sale. That is, Manny Marable's book will be on sale, as well as Bill Sells' book, From Civil Rights to Black Liberation. And Bill Sells is a big person, is big on the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley. And Manny Marable basically says that because Alex Haley was a Republican and so on and so forth, he really is trying to poo-poo Alex Haley's book. I personally think that people should read it. And an autobiography is, I guess, essentially what you want.
It's still the definitive book, isn't it?
I would say so, yes.
I mean, that's how they said it. You want it. And that book, you have to underline, it inspired people. There's
right.
a lot of public figures today who said they read the book, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, and they were inspired by it.
Well, you know, like if you read the book, like when it first... page of the book, you know, it has errors, but Malcolm, that's the one thing that we learned about Malcolm X was he was a human being. He made errors. For example, he talked about Marcus Aurelius Garvey, and he was Marcus Mosiah Garvey. he didn't talk that much about his mother in the autobiography, but I would argue that he was so traumatized because his mother was in a mental institute.
Yeah.
Until 1989, his mother lived until 1989. His mother, of course, being from Grenada. So you know,
there's a chapter I would like to learn about. By the way, I assume stuff like that'll come up at this.
Oh yeah, because Jan Carew, who lived in Toronto, wrote a book called Blood and I can't remember the name of Jan's book, but Jan Carew did a book where he basically went back to Grenada and interviewed people that knew Malcolm X's mother, and he interviewed Malcolm's older brother, wow. Wilfred. And, you know, it's very interesting that Malcolm's mother and father met in Montreal at a Marcus Garvey convention.
Now there you got it. See, a detail like that will set the mind conjuring. Norman, we have to go. It's Norman Otis Richmond, and it's going to be Saturday, am I right, October 1?
Saturday, October 1, 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., different book list.
That's
746 Bathurst Street, Toronto.
Very good.
And the phone number is 416-538-0889, and we are encouraging everyone to come out, and this is definitely not an anti-Manny Mirable moment, because we knew Manny Mirable.
It's a Malcolm moment.
Right, but we brought Manny Mirable to Toronto, and I used to play Manny Mirable's speeches or his radio broadcast on my radio show at CKLN, and we also helped Manny Mirable get his column in Pride newspaper, so we are not... We don't see Manny Mirable as an enemy. We just basically think that we disagree with him on
some points.
Interpretation of Malcolm, right?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Otis, very much. It sounds like an interesting program, and I know a lot of people are going to turn up. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye. Norman Otis Richmond. And, by the way, Phil Conlon is here, and Phil, while we're waiting to speak to Keith, can you tell us there's something going on at City Hall?
Yes, there is an event going on at City Hall right now. The City Council is having a budget debate, which Rob Ford and the Tories have tried to frame as we've got to dump all kinds of services, mostly services to the poor. That's what we have to really get rid of.
Yes.
There's a lot of people fighting back. There's a lot of union people there, a lot of community organizations, a lot of daycare advocates, neighborhood associations, and Ford is actually finding that his bully act is wearing a little thin on some of the people on City Council.
Well, you know, that's because, you know, Margaret Atwood, who, as we know, is a big, powerful person, she scares those Fords. She's tried to help on the economy, but she says, we don't need two Fords, do we? We got to get rid of one. Anyhow, that's going on at City Hall. So we live in dramatic times, and we have an important author with us, Keith Bolander, who is the author of Voices from the Other Side, an oral history of terrorism against Cuba. And he's Keith has an important course starting soon. Keith, are you there?
Yes, I am, Phil. How are you doing?
Not bad. Tell us about this course you're offering.
Well, it's a course on Cuba. I'm lecturing it at the University of Toronto, the School of Continuing Studies, and it's going to start October 25th and run for 6 weeks, one night a week, Tuesday nights to November 29th, and it's going to be on Cuba, the history of Cuba, starting from the early days when it was colonized by the Spanish, and then obviously more focus during the 60 years that America had it, and then the last few weeks will be dedicated to Cuba since the revolution. So it's quite an interesting course. It's the second time I've offered it, and hopefully it'll do well.
Yeah, and people should, it's at learn.utoronto.ca, right? They should go to that site?
Yes, exactly. Anyone that's interested can go to that site. That is the website of the continuing studies, and they can access the course information and more details from there.
Yeah, so it's Tuesdays and starting October 25. And I notice you're going to, of course, we have, Cuba is always in the news one way or the other. Today, Fidel Castro has an analysis of Obama's United Nations speech. And, you know, he's an old veteran, so he's heard a lot of these speeches. And there's speculation about the Cuban economy. Can you... You have visited Cuba, spent a lot of time, you interviewed these individuals for this great book, Voices from the Other Side. What is the core of that matter? And if do you see a difference? I mean, what is going on new in the Cuban economy?
Yeah, I was there just last week, actually, doing some research, and the Cuban economy is undergoing some pretty dramatic reforms. The new president Raul Castro has instituted some serious economic reforms that are just starting to have some effect. I was in Havana for the weekend, and I definitely noticed some impact. There's a lot more private taxi cabs on the streets. There's a lot more private restaurants and food places, and the response of the Cubans is been fairly positive overall. There's still tremendous hesitancy because the Cuban economy is still very, very bad, but there is some optimism and hope that these reforms will actually have an effect in the city and then across Cuba as well. So there's some quiet optimism, and the Cubans are in general taking a wait-and-see attitude, but there are some definite signs that the government is releasing some of the more stringent aspects of a command economy.
By the way, the type of economy they've had and have is certainly not unrelated to the long history that you describe of their problems with Spain and then the United States. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, very much so. Since the revolution, since the early years of the revolution, the United States government has had a very comprehensive economic blockade against Cuba that has really had a tremendously detrimental effect on the Cuban economy in so many aspects. Not only can they not trade directly with the United States for import and export, but the American laws have tremendous extraterritoriality effects on companies throughout the world, including Canadian companies that are subsidiaries of U.S. firms that cannot trade with Cuba, as well as European companies and a lot of other companies that who are looking to do trading with Cuba but can't because of the American laws. And it really has had a tremendous negative effect on the Cuban economy. It forced them to go to markets outside the United States. The United States is 90 miles away. It's the most natural market. So consequently, the Cubans find themselves purchasing so many things at higher costs. And then the whole aspect of not being able to access American technology and American medical medicines and medical equipment has had a real negative effect on the economy, too. So the Cuban economy for a third world is difficult enough, but it's made tremendously worse by American policy.
There's a sadness, a tragic thing about the relations. You went to, the last time you and I spoke, you had gone to, I think it was El Paso, to witness the case of the terrorist from Miami who had illegally entered the United States, and the U.S. sort of shrugged it off. That court shrugged it off, and he's at liberty. I mean, that speaks to a rather profound bitterness. And then we have the Cuban Five. Do we ever see on behalf of the United States, instances where they show a little compassion and simply say, well, why don't we start with something small like release the Cuban Five or maybe incarcerate the known terrorists? Do you see any signs?
If there are any signs, they're well hidden. I haven't seen much of that. Now, the trial of the gentleman you were referring to, Luis Posada Carriles, in El Paso, was back in January, and he was just tried on some minor immigration and perjury charges, and he's living a quiet life in Miami now. One of the Cuban Five, one of them is actually being released next month. Rene Gonzalez, his sentence is over, and he will be released October 7th now. He has a 3-year probation following his release, and right now there's discussions between Cuba and the United States. The Cuban government wants Rene released immediately back into Cuba. The American government has just ruled that he will have to serve his 3 years parole probation in Miami. So there's very, very little ability for either side to seemingly compromise on public issues like this. It's unfortunate because one terrorist is living freely in Miami, and one of the Cuban Five, who many believe had nothing to do with the charges he was given, is forced to live in the United States in Miami, and his wife is actually concerned for his life.
Well, I would think so. As my understanding, he actually doesn't have any family in that area. It's almost an invitation for someone to harm him.
He's a U.S. citizen, and he does not have family in the United States anymore. And the negotiation was that he would renounce his U.S. citizenship in return for the United States to release him back into Cuba. And I believe there's still negotiations going on, but so far that has been rejected by the American side.
Mm-hmm. By the way, there is a site at the freethefive.com, am I right?
Yes. There's a number of websites, a number of organizations in the United States and around the world that support the release of the five and give you the complete background on the case and how it's gone through the courts.
We're speaking to Keith Bolliter. He's the author of Voices from the Other Side, An Oral History of Terrorism Against Cuba. It has an introduction by Noam Chomsky. And Keith is offering a course at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies, and it's going to be, it begins Tuesday, October 25, and it runs through to November 29, and you can go to learn.utoronto.ca. Keith, there's a matter of this. We have the President of the United States who doesn't seem to be able to make a kind of simple decision. We had a young black man in Georgia. Everybody understands that there's a lot of racism. Certainly the president knows that. And that the courts are not fair to African-Americans. And then you have also a matter such as the issue of this Cuban who has done his time and is could be paroled, could be sent home to Cuba. But the president always says, what people say of the president, he can't do that. He'd get in too much trouble. He'd lose Florida. Or if he were to not execute that black man, he'd lose Georgia. I mean, it's an amazing situation, isn't it?
Yeah, when it comes to Cuba in particular, there's no other consideration but politics. And Florida remains a very important swing state that we've seen in the last 20 years, how important it is in the election of American presidents. And even though Obama won in 2008 with a substantial support of the Cuban-American community, and he didn't have to rely on the hard right first-generation exiles, he's still been very, very strict in his policies against Cuba, and there's been tremendous disappointment within the Cuban leadership as well as in the United States, Cuban watchers who were expecting a lot more from him, and he's basically he did allow Cuban Americans to travel to Cuba freely with no restrictions, but he has maintained solid support for the continuation of travel restrictions for average Americans. Mm-hmm. And just a month and a half, 2 months ago, he maintained the legislative response to the blockade under the Trading with the Enemy Act. So He appears to all intents and purposes to maintain the blockade and the travel restrictions. So, in fact, his position is very not a great deal different than his predecessor towards Cuba.
Yeah. He acts like a political hostage rather than a president. We're speaking to Keith Bolliter. And again, that course is going to begin October 25 and run to November 29. It's learn.utoronto.ca. If you would like to take it. How about the status of Cuba with it has some friends. It's developed pretty good relations now with very good relations with Venezuela and some other countries. I guess their relations are pretty good with Brazil. That has to be kind of a surprise to the U.S., doesn't it? I mean, after all their years of beating on Cuba and surrounding it, that Cuba's been able to develop these new relations with rising political states.
The relationship Cuba has with Latin America is probably the best it has ever been since the revolution. You have a number of left and center-left governments throughout Latin America. The ones you mentioned, including Peru, Argentina, and a number of others that have very strong relations with Cuba. And the Americans have sort of taken their eyes off of Latin America since their war against terrorism, focusing more on the Middle East. And that's exactly the reaction of so many of the Latin American leaders that have said, you know, now is the opportunity to start solving our problems our way, without the direct interference of the great, you know, northern power. So it's really been an interesting political shift in the last 10 years in Latin America. And Cuba finds itself very much among a lot of friends in Latin America now, which is good for them economically and politically.
And for their security, I assume.
Very much so. Well, Venezuela, for obvious reasons, has have been their number one supporter since Hugo Chavez.
Yes.
But there's a lot of other countries in Latin America that have very good relations with Cuba right now.
They're rather proud of that, right? I mean, it is their way to show that they are Latin Americans, and he knows they share his sense of the problem with the northern power.
There's tremendous respect, and sometimes it's tempered because, you know, if they make too much noise, then the Americans will start noticing them again. So, but there's been a very consistent amount of leaders and officials from Latin America visiting Cuba in the last 4 or 5 years, and there's been a lot of attention within the Latin American community to what Cuba has accomplished and what they are still dealing with, particularly after the world economic crisis, how Cuba has been able to maintain its social programs under those conditions, plus the American embargo. So there's a tremendous interest in Cuba and Latin America now, which is good.
Good. Well, that tells us why people ought to attend your course at the University of Toronto School of Continuing Studies at learn.utoronto.ca. It's Keith Bolander. And, Keith, thank you very much for joining us.
Phil, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. We'll talk again. Okay. Bye-bye. And Phil Khanna is here, and he wants to jump in with a word as well.
Well, yes, and it ties right in. On Thursday, October the 6th, it's an annual day in Cuba called the Day of the Victims of State Terrorism, and there will be an event at Bates Atún that evening, and October the 6th, 1973, was the day that terrorists sponsored by the U.S. government blew a plane out of the sky, killed dozens and dozens of Cubans, especially a team of young athletes. And Bates Atún will have the Cuban consul general speaking that evening, and there will be some Cuban musicians and stuff. And that's at Bates Atún on Markham Street, Thursday the 6th at 7 to 9 p.m.
This coming Thursday?
It's a week, pardon me, on the 6th. On the 6th at Bates Atún. And it's called the Day of the Victims of State Terrorism, and it is an annual commemoration in Cuba to commemorate that terrible day in their history. I mean, people here like to talk about 9/11. For them, it's October the 6th.
Yeah, and by the way, and 9/11 for Chileans is the murder of their elected president and the coup, which was openly and enthusiastically supported by the United States.
And for whom no one has ever been brought to justice.
But Noam Chomsky is very eloquent on that subject because he does the math of how many people were killed, how many people went to prison, how many homes were destroyed in that coup. And he says, so for the Chileans, 9/11 resonates, but in a way that nobody, you know, it's the old thing, if you want sympathy for your pain, you have to recognize that somebody else has pain. I think we've just about done it. I want to one more time, Phil. There is a demonstration going on at City Hall.
At City Hall right now. It's going to go on until 7:30.
And it's organized by the...
And it's organized by lots and lots of people who believe in municipal government should provide services. And go on down to City Hall right now and tell Rob and Doug, the twin mayors, what you think.
The twin, yes, our little twins. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. You can check us out, taylor-report.com, and write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. I want to thank Rose for great work, and we'll see you next week.